ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Fabian Riegel, founder of Secret Cinema. Launched in 2007, Secret Cinema has become a leader in the world of immersive experiences. From grassroots film screenings in abandoned London buildings to large-scale productions in some of the most spectacular spaces worldwide, they're known for creating 360-degree participatory secret worlds where the boundaries between performer and audience, set and reality are constantly shifting. Fabian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much as well.
For people who don't already know about you and Secret Cinema, can you tell me a little bit about your background and how, why you founded Secret Cinema and give the audience sort of the view from 50,000 feet?
Sure. I'm the founder and creative director of Secret Cinema. I launched Secret Cinema back in 2007. Secret Cinema is a new way of experiencing films. We put on multi-layered immersive experiences where instead of watching a film, you become part of a film. And we essentially create a highly detailed, imagined theatrical world that you can step inside. And then we enhance the screening of that film by bringing it to life whilst the audience are watching.
Okay, so you recently put on Romeo and Juliet, right? That was in August, I think, that you launched that. And has that come to, or Romeo plus Juliet, my bad. Has that come to a close, that event?
That closed on the towards the end of August.
So in just to understand how it works, so you create an immersive experience, but they're also screening the film as well during the process. How does it actually... I guess, how does that work? I know I sound really dim, but I just am having trouble. I sort of understand participation and being deep in an experience, but how do you show the film sort of in pieces, or are there actors? Can you give me a little bit, like an example, I guess?
Yeah, sure. So I'll give you an example. So say, for example, with Back to the Future, the way we treated Back to the Future was to build the town of Hill Valley on an empty... empty site in East London. And so when you buy a ticket, you get sent to a website, and on that website you get given an identity and you get given a character, and then you become part of this online world where you get initiated into the story of Back to the Future. So we create a parallel world of the film. And when you arrive, then you get sent to the... So when you get to your email and your character, you get given a costume that you have to wear, where you have to go and either, you know, find a costume. And then when you arrive at the experience, we build the world of the film. So you arrive into Hill Valley, and there's the diner, and there's the clock tower, and the cinema, and all the shops that are featured in the film, and then the school. And you get to interact. There are around 60 actors in each different production, and you become part of that world.
Wow. So you come in and you're part of the world, but and the film is also screened, though, right? Does it sort of, do you have the interaction and then you sit in a
yes.
theater to see the film, or does it get played against walls, or and sometimes the actors are doing scenes? How is the film coherent, just one film, or is it also chopped up and made more of an experience?
No, it's not chopped up at all. Essentially, you enter the world of the film that we've created, and you interact inside that world. It's an immersive theatrical experience of that film. And then after a period of time, maybe a few hours, then there is a transition that goes into the screening of the film, which is filmed in an environment that fits the film. So, for example, with Back to the Future, we projected it onto the town hall that we'd built, and the audience sat down and watched and experienced the film. But as you're watching the film, the DeLorean would drive around you, Doc Brown would fly above you, and actors would be integrated into the narrative of the experience.
Oh, okay. All right. A lot of it is centered around cult classic films, right? How do you go about choosing your films for your secret worlds? And then I was curious about Romeo plus Juliet, because it seemed a bit different, like Blade Runner, or, you know, I mean, that different group of people.
Yeah, I mean, we curate the slate and really to give the sort of a wide and eclectic mix of different worlds that we call them, but shows that we put on. So Blade Runner was very much influenced by, first of all, it was our 10-year anniversary. So we wanted to do a film that we'd done back in 2010. We wanted to do a film that was highly relevant to what's going on today with the sort of over-automation and the technology that is sort of controlling our lives and AI and all these different things, as well as the sort of breakdown of data with the whole Facebook scandal and all this. So we try and mix up how we do films. They're sort of culturally relevant to what's going on in the news today. They are relevant when it comes to creating experience. Blade Runner's got a very rich world to build. So we did this, and over 70,000 people attended. And, you know, these are sort of large, large productions. And then Romeo and Juliet was very much part of our format, which is a sort of, sorry, our part of the festival format that we put on, which are outdoor, much larger scale. So imagine a small music festival. There are 5,000 people a night. And it's very much done on a massive scale. So, you know, we built Sycamore Grove. There was the Capulet Mansion and the Montague area, and it was almost like going to a music festival, but one that is basically as if you are inside the vision of Baz Luhrmann's mind.
Oh, okay. So in that, do you partner then with the studios and rights holders for the films? I mean, for instance, was Baz Luhrmann at all involved with your putting together of Romeo plus Juliet?
We partner, yeah, we work very closely with the studios. I wouldn't say we partner, they license the film for us to be able to go and build a theatrical world out of them. So they're sort of, they're partners to a certain extent, but they're more like, you know, they supply the rights. And then in terms of the talent, you know, both Ridley Scott, Wes Anderson, all of the different directors we work with endorse the projects and, you know, approve them, but tend to not be involved in the creation of them. For example, Baz Luhrmann came to the Romeo and Juliet experience that we did as an audience member.
Oh, fun. That's great. So how long does it take to develop one of these experiences? I mean, it seems in order to really make it work, it would take a certain amount of time. I mean, like, what's the project schedule before you're ready to launch look like?
It takes around 6 months. We work very quickly because I think it's quite, there's sort of extraordinarily challenging productions to put on, because we're having to find the right venues, the right sites, buildings that perhaps are factories that have never been used before for a venue. So I'd say about 6 months from the beginning to doing them. But actually, that's been a very fast turnaround. But we're looking really now that we're developing projects 12 months ahead.
Yeah, it seems like you also, I mean, it's such an investment. You create the sets, working up the storylines, building the website. Do you then sort of take it on the road, if you will, like, you know, bring it to another city, bring it to the United States, bring it to, you know, bring it somewhere else, because you've already, you know, you have all this intellectual property. You know, or is it one and done?
Well, so for the past 10 years, we've done 46 productions and we've remounted some of them. But now is really very much the time where we're going to be taking Secret Cinema internationally. And so, you know, we have a really big team now. And now we're in a position where we can take the foundations which we've built over the last 10 years and now turn it into something that's going to be global. So, you know, we're very much in the process of developing our international launch to take it all around the world. Because we feel very much that what we stepped into is the future of the way that I think people will experience cinema, but also other areas such as music and art and other areas.
Well, it's interesting. I think one of the things I've found in interviewing people is that playfulness and is something that people are desperate for, you know, the sense of fun and exploration and play. And it's been so leached out of everything that I can see why this would really appeal. You know, it's fun. You have to really make that leap and get into costume and be in character. And then you get to play. And how many people have stopped playing in their lives? I can, you know, I'm sure you must get repeat participants from topic to topic. Do you track that?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we very much so. I mean, Secret Cinema is very much about play. It's about participation. It's about being able to lose yourself away from the kind of slight repetitive and predictable kind of life that I think things have become. I think people need adventure and mystery in times where everything's, you know, everything's available and everything's just a click away. So I think, yeah, secret cinema is very much about play, and it's very much about connectivity in a world in which no one's really connected anymore, even though they say they are. You know, we seal everyone's phones. Phones are not allowed. Mobile phones are not allowed at our productions.
That's actually something I'm very curious about, because I did read that, and I'm curious in terms of a lot of content discovery these days for traditional media happens through social networks. And part of that is often, you know, look at me taking a selfie of me at this event, or me in this place, or me at this thing. So in some ways preventing that, or do you have a separate, like, you can do it outside, but you can't do it in the event, you can do it after, but not during? I mean, how do you balance the benefit that a social network and the way that kind of network distributes information and helps share interest from what it does to the actual event? And I think it's great you don't allow the phones in there, but I'm curious how you still tap into the power of a social network.
I mean, we very much have, when people buy a ticket, they get sent to a website, and we create an entire kind of online world of the story that we're doing, or the film that we're doing. So people get very much involved. We pretty much build a small social network for every show we do. And what we do, I think, is through that is promote folks to get involved in playing out their characters online, in exchanging messages with other participants. But we very much like to use social networks in which to promote and create a sort of community, but very much with the aim that it has a goal in which people will meet and connect with each other in real life in the world of the film, at the production. So, you know, for example, the audience are told what to wear, but are also told to bring different items that connect them to the production. That's a big part of it. So Romeo and Juliet, you know, they were told to bring various different props and various different, that allow them to connect with each other. It's kind of like a way of connecting with the story. So, no, I mean, we very much use social media.
Well, I guess I didn't clarify my question, because I understand that sort of all the social network and how it functions within and tightening the connection of the participants. What I'm curious about is how people who aren't yet attending, how do they find out about it? And you know, how, so my friend just went to this thing, and it was really cool, and they want to share that they went to this thing. They don't have any photographs, though, to share, or they don't have. So how does that, how do you use it in a sense? I guess I'm asking marketing and promotion. Or is the whole point that it's secret and that's not what you do? And so it's a dog leg, it's different. And that's what people like.
No, I mean, it's, you know, the secrecy of it is something which I think is extraordinary, that we're able to, you know, on some of our Tell No One productions where we don't reveal the film, we have 25,000 people attend and they don't reveal what the film is to other people online, and no one mentions it online. And I think we're one of the only organizations in the world, well, number one, that can sell 25,000 tickets without telling people what they're going to experience.
Yeah, that's a neat trick.
And also that they go to the experience and then they don't reveal what happened to them. What they do reveal is that they went to Secret Cinema, and hopefully they reveal good things, and they're like, you know, it was an extraordinary world, and, you know, you've got to go, but I can't tell you anything. So it's almost like that I really believe in secrecy as a form of marketing, because the more you tell people stuff, the more desperate maybe it sounds that it's something, you know, like the less you say and the less you talk about, it sounds kind of more exciting and more intriguing. And so that's a big part of it, the secrecy. But we, you know, we photograph and we film all of our experiences, and they all then become distributed after the main one. But even there's two sides of Secret Cinema. Secret Cinema Tell No One, we don't say anything, and Secret Cinema Presents, where we reveal what the film is. Even in those situations, you know, we still think very hard about marketing, and we have a great marketing department and very, you know, really good creative team who get involved in that side of things. And we still use very much But what we don't want is that when you go to the experience, because it's kind of unusual, and, you know, we really build these epic sets of the movies and et cetera, that people don't have their phones and they're just photographing everything they see. And also, even more importantly, that they don't check their phone every single 5 minutes to see if they've got, you know, more Instagram likes or whatever. It just brings them back to not the world that we want them to experience. It brings them back to their life, which means it's harder to make them believe that they are, you know, in Los Angeles when actually they're in a small dystopian part of East London.
Well, indeed. So to be very present and to not be distracted by these things. I'm curious, are the locations really secret? Do they not leak out where these things are taking place?
Well, we don't reveal the locations. So the locations are not revealed as part of it. And people, you know, tend to not kind of reveal too much about, you know, where they headed and stuff. So we sell the tickets without them knowing what the location is.
That's very fun. Have you ever done anything with scripted content properties like the Game of Thrones, for instance, something like that?
Yeah, we're developing sort of and discussing about the potential to get into the TV format. That's something very much that we're doing, yeah.
Interesting. And I suppose then if you were doing it internationally, you'd have different, depending on locations. Do you have a company? Is it sort of like the Secret Cinema company of actors who, you know, this month they're going to be in Romeo and Juliet, next month they're going to be in Back to the Future, the month after that, you know, I mean, is it a company where people are used to working with you sort of like a theater company, or is it wholly cast each time, new sets of actors, might be some repeats, but that's, you know, essentially there are players for one project and then you audition for the future?
So we have a performance department led by Tom Maller and Lucy Ridley, who we have a kind of, I guess, a community of actors that we work with, but we cast it fresh every time. It's very much like any film production or theatre show. We cast it fresh and we get the best actors that fit that film. But I think what's different about Secret Cinema compared to other immersive experiences also is just that what we do is really try and build very real and detailed worlds. They have real, real integrity. If we're creating a prison for Shawshank Redemption, it will feel like a prison. It will be like you're going to prison. It is not a show. It is a world. And it's something that we don't want people to act, as it were. So they're actors, but they are basically becoming real characters, if that makes sense. Because
right, well, they're not sort of acting. They're being.
Yeah, they're exactly right. They're being. And it's just, I think the basic principle is that if you're an actor and you're performing on a stage, you're elevated and you are separate from the audience. This audience are becoming actors themselves. And, you know, when 5,000 people come each night for Romeo and Juliet, and you have, I think, close to 60 actors that were working with this, you need to be able to guide and be that character and allow the audience to then, almost like they're directing the audience and that our performance team are directing the actors. It's a really unusual craft, and it's learning how to break the fourth wall. It's learning how to improvise in a way in which, you know, you will have participants who will challenge you and who will not necessarily stick to the script and will look, you know, and that's what I find very exciting about Secret Cinema, is that it allows, you know, that any audience member to become a character themselves and change the narrative.
Right. So there's an element of improv that is baked in, right? I mean, you've got to roll with
it. It's all improv. I mean, it's like, you know, they build characters and they go through detailed practice of learning their own characters and the worlds in which these characters inhabit. And obviously they study the film and they work with the performance team. But essentially they then have to then deal with. I mean, it's an extraordinarily challenging and I think very satisfying part of acting, you know, is to be able to, for 6 hours, become another character and then have to deal with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of participants who are also, you know, becoming other characters. And you know, it's a tough, but it's, I think, very rewarding.
Right, right. I'm curious, in terms of revenue streams, obviously you have the ticket sales. When you're at one of these events and you've made the Back to the Future town and somebody goes to the diner, are they purchasing food? Are there other embedded revenue streams, and are those incidental or are those critical? I mean, one thinks in the theater, refreshments are often pretty important to their financial picture. What are the other revenue streams or that feed into the event for you?
I mean, it's like any, I think like any music festival, theatrical production, you know, you pay for a ticket and then you pay for drinks and you pay for food and you pay for merchandise. I mean, it's all integrated into it. But I think where we're different is that, for example, when we did Shawshank Redemption, we couldn't have bars or restaurants because it was a prison. So everything was on the black market. And we actually created when you arrived, you went into court, you were charged with a crime, and then afterwards you were asked by sort of crooked lawyers if you wanted to have access to the black market in prison, and then sort of exchanged money for library tokens, and those library tokens became the currency to buy food and drink in the prison. But there were no bars, there were just other prisoners with drinks in their jackets, you know?
Oh, fun. What fun. That's great.
So it's all integrated into the whole of the experience is in the character of, you know, like the entire experience. So all of the security guards, the food staff, the bar staff go into rehearsals as actors. All the food is curated to match the film. So when we did Blade Runner, we rebuilt the noodle bar where Deckard eats noodles. They were the same noodles. And the people serving the noodles, you know, they live in LA. It's LA 2019 rather than it being, you know, it's not like when you go to the theater and the lobbies are run by the theater people, but they're not actually part of the show. Or Cirque du Soleil, for example, you know, it's very much like connected. Yeah. So, but that's what makes it tricky, I think, is that people, you know, we try and make it so that it's completely real, that it's really authentic. The whole thing's in character. But because it's a very unusual and it's never really been done before on the scale that we're doing it, you know, it's, I think it's a challenging thing, which is just setting, you know, the price points and all these different things. But, you know, we feel very much that what we do is great value.
Yeah, well, it sounds fascinating. I'm curious about, you know, it's set in LA next year. Do all of the actors have American accents, or do you not go that far?
Say that again about the LA next.
The accents. So you've got, it takes place in LA. It's not.
I work for England. London. Yeah.
Yeah. So how, or is that just, well, you know, so what? And that's not part of the show.
Oh, no, it's very much part of the show. So essentially for Blade Runner, you know, we picked and found a series of warehouses in East London that felt very dystopian in themselves and created the world of, built the entire set and the world of it with the fact that it became Los Angeles, you know, it became a sort of dystopian part of Los Angeles near Chinatown in Los Angeles. And then the actors, they're actors. So they're trained, you know, very experienced actors. So they, you know, if they can't do accents, then, you know, then they can't.
Then they're out.
Not that they're out, but they do, you know, they work really well and they work really hard on like any actor and on being able to do the right accent. And then I think, you know, yeah, we try and make it authentic. It's, we just, you know, literally it's very simple. We just say, you know, London is now Los Angeles and this area is now downtown Los Angeles. And that's the story and imagine it and believe it. And then, you know, you do. But I think if there's any sort of question that it's a sort of parody of what we're trying to do, then it becomes a themed experience that's a, sort of more akin to like Comic-Con or things like that, which are fine.
Not right. What we are. Yeah. Right. That's really interesting, and it's a fine line, I imagine, to create that. When a show is on, do you attend? Do you check in? How involved are you in the actual event once they're up and running?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, Secret Cinema has gone, been sort of growing and growing and growing. So now we have, you know, I have a full crew and full team. So we, you know, I have on the business side. I have Max Alexander, who's sort of running the company as the CEO. And then there is a huge team now, huge team of creative. So my role now within Secret Cinema is guiding and kind of mentoring and overseeing the creative rather than being there day to day. But I'm very much involved in all of the productions in terms of just supporting and organizing and making sure that they are, you know, they're going the right way. But no, I mean, very much sort of was involved with every aspect of every show up until Blade Runner this year. And now sort of gradually, it's just not possible because the amount of shows that we're going to be doing and all of this. And so that I'm sort of very much, you know, in the background, but very much making sure that everything's happening. But my particular thing on Romeo and Juliet was that this was the first show that Matt Bennett, who's one of a creative who we brought on to work in the music side of Secret Cinema, really came on like full strides to sort of oversee that project as a creative director. And it was like the first one that I stepped back, and it was really wonderful because he brought such a brilliant sort of flair to it, and it became, you know, it was really a special show. And so just seeing it, you know, seeing it happen like that, and I would come in once a week for a few, you know, like sort of a day or two a week in overseeing and going through everything, but then I would then be there for the launch and all that. So yeah.
Right. Wow. So you really are scaling then. What is up next for you? I mean, out there, obviously you mentioned looking at the TV format, you mentioned going international. Are you doing both things simultaneously? How do you leverage your time? What is next for you and Secret Cinema, sort of short term, the balance of, well, I guess, a year and then 5 years? What do you see happening?
I see that we're going to be growing internationally and moving Secret Cinema in new cities around the world. I think, you know, initially with America, and then I think Europe, and then, you know, it's going to be growing quite quickly. We established such a strong foundation in London. So I think that's going to be the big one. And then I think developing new areas such as TV is an area that we're looking at, and other areas where Secret Cinema can sort of reimagine things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when am I going to be able to see something over here in the US? Because it seems really, really cool. And when could I expect that something might be in New York?
Well, I think it's actually happening right now, just down the street from you. I've just organized a little Secret Cinema. You just need to like go down the lift and it's there. There'll be a man there, like he's wearing a raincoat. He's going to come up to you and he's going to ask you if your name is Doolittle. No, I'm joking. No, Secret Cinema, I mean, like in the US, I reckon you can see it there in the next, you know, between year and year and a half. I reckon, you know, we're in a position where we've been developing it for a lot of years, and it's really now time to move on to, you know, to get it going there. It's just, it's a complex operation. And when we do it in the US, we want it to be on the same scale as we do in England. And we want it to be, you know, and what's going to be amazing is just all the learnings that we've made, so that, you know, when it does arrive in New York, I think it's going to be really special. And yeah, and we want to take it all over America. So,
yeah, well, it seems really great. And I look forward to being able to secretly go sometime in New York in the next, hopefully, year and change. We have run through our time. Thank you so much. The last thing, I guess, is where can people find out more about you and more about Secret Cinema?
You can follow me on various things. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff. And then Secret Cinema, you know, we're on secretcinema.org, and you can also find it through Facebook, Instagram, and other areas.
Great. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's really fascinating.
Thank you so much as well.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.